Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a 93-year-old veteran remembers his time as a World War II pilot and shares the unlikely manner in which he met his wife of 72 years.
She looked at me and she says, "You're too old for my sister." I said, "What are you doing?" So we went to the movies.
They're still together, and she did something pretty interesting in World War II as well. Hear the whole story today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we remind you that no matter where you live in our great country, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are people that have done incredible things for the sake of our freedom, and each week we meet them. As we honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, we want their stories to be preserved so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure learn a lot. Sometimes we're even inspired by the things that we hear. And the first thing I have to say today, I don't know about inspired yet, but I sure am amazed by the length and depth and breadth of the Air Force career of the gentleman we're going to meet today. Retired Lieutenant Colonel John Decker. And you live in Merced, is that right, or Atwater?
Merced,
but we're visiting here in Atwater at the beautiful Castle Air Museum. And have you done an inventory of all the planes on the grounds here and counted how many of them you actually flew? Because I think you flew quite a few.
Well, I figured at least, I didn't actually check, but I figured about at least one-third of them I've flown.
Yeah.
Because I started out my career in 1941. And as a result, the Air Force had some airplanes from the 30s, plus the new ones.
And the different things that they had you doing in your career gave you access to a lot of these planes that some people have seen, some people have heard about, but you actually experienced from the cockpit. 93 years old. You don't look 93. What's your secret to staying so young?
Having a good-looking wife.
Well, you guys haven't been married that long, though. How long?
Only 72 years.
Only 72 years. Keep working on it. Get back to me. We're going to get the story of how you met and the secret to your success in that part of your life. But let's go back early on. You grew up a New Yorker. Maybe we'll hear a few little latent parts of the New York accent as we get through this interview. What was life like growing up in New York in the 30s?
Well, it went from living out in the island, Long Island, where it was mostly farmland, and then became, after World War I, a community for overflow from Manhattan. Then it became a urban-type city. It grew up from looking out at farmland to looking out at housing, and it built quite a few after World War I. Other than that, I went through the normal thing of grade school, college. I went to Long Island University.
You're a football player?
I had a football scholarship and played football in the fall and rugby in the spring until one day my father came home with his ad, and it said, showed a picture of a man with a helmet, goggles, leather jacket, and a parachute on his butt. And it says, "You too can become an Army aviation cadet and earn between $120 and $140 a month."
And how much money was that? Because, I mean, here you'd lived through the Depression. I imagine that sounds like a pretty good fortune there.
Well, yes, but when you say it now, it doesn't seem very much. And the thing is, I couldn't figure out why one second lieutenant was worth $120 and another one $140. And if I'd explained it to me, $140 was for a married officer. Uh-huh. So when my wife came down to my girlfriend came down to put on my wings and everything else, and my father said, "I'm leaving her here," I figured, I'm going to get the $140.
Sure, that's not the only reason you proposed. Tell me how you and Ruth met.
Well, I use the thing that's not quite true, but she had two sisters, total of three girls in the house, and her middle sister was a blonde, and I just somehow met her, and some of you remember the phrase that blondes have more fun. So I asked her to go to movies with me. She says, "Fine."
This is the sister.
That's the sister. Uh-huh. And I came out to the house and knocked on the door, and she came to the door, Ruth. And she says, what do you want? I said, I got a date with your sister. And she looked at me and she says, you're too old for my sister. So I said, well, I said, what are you doing? So we went to the movies.
And who knew at that moment that you'd have 72 years together, huh? Is that a little hard to believe in retrospect?
Well, my wife has a saying she has for all the people she runs into. Is what?
Let's get this from Ruth. Go ahead.
Don't get old. Find something else to do.
And that works for you?
Yes, it does.
Well, and tell me, in that moment when he came to the door, what possessed you to say what you said? And did he just give us the true story there?
Pretty much, yes. He was too old for my sister. But she, like he said, she was a blonde, blue-eyed blonde, and everybody hit on her first. But I was her older sister, so I intercepted.
And did you have any inkling that when you said those things that you'd be stuck with this guy all these years later?
No, not the slightest inkling. I had all kinds of other plans, and grow up in New York and go to work in New York and get married in New York eventually, but that was way down the road.
So you get married. This is 1941. You're already a cadet. You're in the service. Where were you when Pearl Harbor happened? What do you remember about that?
Oh, I was laying in bed on Sunday, December 7th, waiting to be graduated on December 12th, and I heard this radio broadcast and the president, and I said, uh-oh, here we go. And sure enough, we did. I left for England 3 months later and was the first combat outfit in England. And we were there before the end of the Battle of Britain. And as a result, we then got on a ship to go down to Northwest Africa and evade Africa.
And I want to hear about all that, but just so I understand the timeline, when exactly did you get married? Was that right after Pearl Harbor or a few months?
5 days after Pearl Harbor. She came from New York with my father and pinned on my wings. And then my father said, I'm leaving her here. So I figured I was obligated to do something. So I graduated at 12 and I got married at 4. As only a second lieutenant bachelor for 4 hours.
So 4 hours passed before you got that promotion and that $20 raise, huh?
Right.
They didn't make you wait for that?
No, my next paycheck came out, $140.
So, and you mentioned going to England. You know, most guys that I talked to, even those that were in the service, it still took a while before their training was complete and they got where they were going. But you guys went over there really early, and you're a pretty young guy at the time. What was going through your mind as you headed across the Atlantic and prepared for unforeseen circumstances? Do you remember what that felt like, leaving a young wife behind and not knowing what your future held?
Well, yes, and not only that, we had to go by ship, and it was the largest ship convoy at the time, and they had submarine warfare going on, and we got south of Greenland and entered deep fog, and we could hear the other ships going woo, woo, and then all of a sudden it lifted 3 days later, and there were no other ships in there except us. And we were a little concerned about, are we going to make it to England? But we made it. We made Northern Ireland first, and then we got to Southern England and debarked.
I know you guys hadn't been married very long, but was it difficult to say goodbye to Ruth? Did you have any great words of wisdom, or was that an emotional moment for you? What was that like?
Well, I quickly learned that in the service, you have to do what they tell you to do. And so when we went from graduation, we got orders to report to Fort Dix, New Jersey, and it said, without delay. And no one explained to me that in the service that means 500 miles a day. I didn't even have a car. So a friend of mine going up to Connecticut said, why don't you ride with us? And we rode without delay. Didn't stop except for meals and stuff like that. And at midnight, we arrived in Fort Dix. And I debarked and got a taxi cab and went out there, and they put me up at guest quarters next day. And this was just before Christmas. And next day, the personnel officer said, we don't have what your orders read here, Fort Dix Air Defense Base. So what are your plans? So I said, well, we live out on Long Island and right alongside New Jersey. He says, well, go home for Christmas and come back later. So we did.
I bet that was a very memorable Christmas.
It was. And then I left her there, and I took off. And that's the last time I saw her until I came back 2 years later.
Well, let me come back to Ruth for just a minute here, because I'm sure all the ladies in the audience are putting themselves in your shoes and wondering what that must have felt like. Here, you just married this guy, and now he's going halfway around the world and putting his life in danger. What was that like for you?
Well, it was kind of worrisome, but everybody else in the area was doing the same thing. All my friends were either getting married or their husbands were going overseas someplace.
Did you have doubt whether he'd be back? Was there part of you that feared he wouldn't?
No, I don't think so. I knew he was competent, and he had a good airplane, and no. And everybody else was doing the same thing at that time, too.
And what did you do while he was over there?
Oh, I ran into a boy I'd gone to school with, and he said, "Ruth, they're hiring women out at Grumman Aircraft on Long Island. Go out and see if they'll take you." So I went all dressed up like you go to work in New York City, and they were hiring women, but he said, "We won't hire you in a dress. Go home and get a pair of coveralls and come on back." So I worked at Grumman Aircraft, first working on a heat treat tester, because metal has to be heated, and the machine goes through a machine. And then they put me over in Plant 4, which was flight operations, because they wanted somebody small enough to fit behind the pilot and install the automatic pilot. So that's what I did.
Well, that's kind of not every World War II pilot has a wife who's working on aircraft. And I suppose you probably would have trusted any aircraft that she worked on.
Yeah, well, actually, when she started flying in the airplane, installing an automatic pilot, she ended up with more flying time than I had.
Yeah, I don't know if everybody caught that there, but Ruth would actually go up in these airplanes, TBF Avenger torpedo bombers like the ones that made their mark at Midway, and she was small enough that she could climb in and install the autopilot, but that had to take place while the plane was in the air. So she did have you beat in flight time for a while, but I know that didn't last long. You mentioned getting over to England and that you were part of the first combat outfit there, your bomb squadron, the first American unit to bomb targets in Europe during World War II. You had to use British planes until your A-20s arrived. And here you are, 21-year-old kid, getting your first taste of war up close and personal. What did you experience over there in England?
Well, our first arrival at an airport there was an RAF base. We heard Lord Hehor in Germany, who was propaganda, and he was announcing the fact that the 15th Light Bomb Squadron has arrived at Kettering RAF base. And if you'd look out, and he said, "It's too bad, too, because you're not going to last very long. And if you go out in the front and look at the gate, one of the hinges are off." You know, this is, huh? So we had an intelligence briefing on you can't write to anybody and say where you are or anything else, but you can send a telegram to your wife. So I sent a telegram and say, "Arrive safely," period. Couldn't say anything else. And the next thing I found out later on was that it was a RCA message, and at the top it says Kettering. So my wife calls RCA and says, "Where's Kettering?" And they said, "Oh, we have two, one in England and one in Australia." Well, she knew I didn't have time to get to Australia, so she knew exactly where I was.
Pays to have a smart wife. She can read between the lines a little bit. And so at this time, with that 15th Squadron, propaganda notwithstanding, you knew what you guys were dealing with. And you were flying an A-20, the Havoc?
That's correct, yes. And it was, of course, it was designed for ground support and wasn't really suited for flights out of England to Europe, because it only had about a 4-hour range on it. So we were finally shipped on the invasion of Africa and to a different unit that we got down at, had A-20s that flew in from the States, and we did submarine patrol in the Mediterranean.
So there in England, I'm sure you're going with high expectations of all the things that you're going to do, and you didn't get to do a lot of what you expected, probably. Was that a disappointment for you, or were you just fine with that, given the circumstances?
Well, we flew a different airplane there. I had a flight one time to go up into the what they call the wash with B-17s flying and pulling a target for them to shoot at. And when I landed, they say, "You got to get packed and leave." And that was the beginning of the invasion of Northwest Africa. I put my stuff in my trunk, carried my bag, got on a car, and they drove me up to Scotland and got on a boat. Then we went down to the invasion of Africa, arriving in just to the east of Oran, Algeria. Of course, there was a lot of firing going on and everything else, but they cleared them out in a hurry.
So this is not an unopposed landing in North Africa. You're coming in, and there's still a lot of action going on there. Was that nerve-wracking for you? Did that get your attention a little bit?
Well, when you're young and bold, you're looking forward to something like this. But when we did debark and come out of the rowboats, one of our men was firing a rifle down the street, and I said, "What are you firing at?" He says, "See that chimney down there about two blocks?" He says, "Something moved behind it 5 minutes ago." I said, "I don't think so. Stop firing." And they started, finally said, "Cease firing," all over. And the only problem was, I ran into a little problem, was that my buddy and I, the squadron commander we had, said, "Go over to the market and check on there. There's some injuries there and see if one of our men." So we went, came back, and they were marching to our rendezvous point, which is about 5 miles outside of town, and all these trucks were going that way. I said to my buddy, I said, hey, we got on the back of one of the trucks and went by our outfit, lined up, guns hanging out and everything else, and we only made one mistake. As we passed, we waved. And we got to the rendezvous point about an hour before everybody else, and our commanding officer came up and said, "What are you guys doing? I got a job for you." And he sent us downtown, back to where we came from, to be ODs, to walk around and make sure there's any prisoners or any incidents that we could take care of. And it was a 4 hours in and 4 hours out job, which we shared a bed in a French house. Then after that, of course, we moved on to Tafarui, which was an air base north of Oran. In that time, the two officers had half a pup tent, and they were still on ship. So the first night we slept at the rendezvous point, it was over a vat in a winery because there was heat coming up. And then we got into the tents, and we were at its airfield north of Oran, and it was muddy, raining, and we finally got into town. That was it. And then we moved on to French Morocco and flew out of there a submarine patrol in the Mediterranean.
And I want to hear about that, but it's time for our first break. 93-year-old retired Lieutenant Colonel John Decker of Merced, California, our guest today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 93-year-old John Decker of Merced, California, originally from Long Island, New York. He spent 28 years in the Air Force, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. But when he signed up before Pearl Harbor, it was still the U.S. Army Air Corps. He told us how he got married just 4 hours after he earned his wings. He and Ruth are still married 72 years later. We heard about his brief time spent in England with the 15th Bomb Squadron, the first American unit to bomb Europe during World War II. In fact, 50 years later, the Royal Air Force gave Mr. Decker and other surviving members of that 15th Squadron the Aircrew Europe Star for the historic joint effort of American and British crews. They even gave a medal to Ruth and two other wives who'd been married to the pilots when they flew those missions and still were married to them all those years later. But when the invasion of North Africa was happening in 1942, Mr. Decker was shipped there, and they had you flying those twin-engine A-20 Havocs on submarine patrol over the Mediterranean. What were those missions like? Were they low altitude? Were they taxing the range of those A-20s? What do you remember about those missions?
We had a definite range we could go. In other words, in 4 hours, 2 hours out, 2 hours back. And we did fly about 1,000 feet looking for any things that might suggest a submarine. We weren't too successful, but however, we did get commendation saying that we had cut down the submarine warfare about 80%, so we felt happy.
So you didn't see a lot of things to drop anything on, but just by your being out there, it was a deterrent.
That's correct, yeah. Then, of course, about a year later, I was sent back to the States on my own by C-47s, so I got to fly from Oran to Algiers, Casbah to Casablanca, Southern Africa, Gold Coast, across to Brazil, Natal, and then to Trinidad, and back to Miami.
That's a lot of hopping. You saw a good chunk of the world that way, huh?
Oh, yeah. And, of course, when I got to Miami, I had flown with a bunch of ferry pilots that were flying on a Pan Am flagboat, and we played poker. And they were better poker players than I was. So I landed in Miami. I had to wire to my father in Long Island and say, "Dad, favorite son back? Need $50 to get on a railroad to get to Long Island." And he said it.
And I'm sure you paid him back. Maybe you learned a lesson there, too. I want to take you back to North Africa. You mentioned those missions patrolling for German submarines, and I imagine that was fairly monotonous, having to be alert enough, to see something, and the rare occasion it actually crops up. Did you ever have any false alarms or anything?
No, it became routine because everything in North Africa was moving toward Egypt, and where we were located in Oran, there weren't any activity at all.
So you never shot at any whales or anything?
No, didn't do that at all.
And what about the life there? Because here you're a big city kid from New York. I know you said there's a lot of farmland on Long Island at the time, but being there in North Africa with these different cultures and with all these other pilots and support crew, what was that like? Did you have some memories that still stand out today?
Yes, it was one of these things like, for example, our flight surgeon walked downtown in Oran with him, and he started pointing out different things, diseases that some of the people had, and some didn't have a hand. He said, well, he was probably a thief, and they cut it off, and things like that, which were kind of startling. And so we got time in Oran, which is a big city, laying there, and I started scratching. And I worked with my buddy, and he said, oh, bed bugs. He gets up and puts his clothes on. Bed bugs, never heard of them. So I got up and stayed outside, went out to the door, and there's a guard with a gun, and he's mumbling. I said, what's the problem? He said, I'm a cook. I'm not a soldier. They put me on guard duty. I'm a cook. I said, well, okay. So the next thing I know, he points his rifle at his toe, and bang, the shoe opens up, and there's no toe. And boy, I don't know what to do. I call the MPs, got them taken care of, and as he goes, he says, well, I'm not going to stay here long. And he went back to the States shooting himself.
Yeah, I imagine you never see those things coming. It alters your perspective. Were there other things that you saw that were difficult to stomach, difficult to take in, realizing that this is war and people are being wounded and dying around you? Did you see much of that?
No, actually it was long range, because particularly when you're in the air, you may see the results later on, but you don't see anything. So you're isolated from actually seeing it, except one of your buddies doesn't come back. Then, of course, you really feel bad about it, but there's nothing you can do. And you're young, bold, and ready to go.
And you said that like you did have buddies that didn't make it back from missions.
One in England on a training mission where they went through a power line, and the guy was in the nose. The airplane survived, but the nose, where part of the navigator was, he was killed. And we all went to the morgue and looked at the man laying there, and it was kind of heartbreaking.
Did you ever take that thought and extrapolate a little bit and say, you know, that could be me? I might not be coming back home?
No, I figured that I was going to make it. In fact, somebody said something about being a hero, and I had it corrected. I wasn't a hero. I was a survivor. And that's the way I felt on it. Actually had more ground accidents or possible killing in a car than I did in an airplane. I had two accidents when I was barely new in the service, airplanes, and survived. And from then on out, as I advanced, They got over 8,000 hours at it. I only probably had a loss of engine or something like that, which is no problem on a four-engine airplane or a six-engine airplane like a B-47. I just look forward to it. I was going to live. I mean.
And where did that assurance come from? I've heard a lot of pilots say, well, I had a picture of my sweetheart in my jacket pocket. Did you carry a photo of Ruth around?
Oh, yes. We all carried 45 guns, and I removed the plates and put glass on them, and in underneath the glass, I put her picture. And, I come to think of it, that was what my good luck charm. And, you know, trouble with the 45 is a type of weapon that is kind of hard to use. We never did use it. We just carried it on every flight, a 45 gun, and never fired it except for practice.
But if you had had to bail out in an area where you could have been taken prisoner, then that was the purpose of having it, just in situations like that?
Well, same thing. Bailing out was not even considered. I mean, in fact, later on, I got into airplanes that we didn't even carry parachutes, like the KC-135 and KC-97. We didn't carry parachutes because we had other people in the airplane, passengers, and didn't have enough parachutes for them. So we came in like airlines. You don't have any parachutes in airplanes.
You mentioned that there were a couple accidents early in your flying career. I bring that up just so I understand, because here you are at 93, looking like you're 75 and feeling great as you approach your 73rd anniversary here with Ruth. And I think an accident, maybe that could have changed all of that. How close a call were those?
The first one I had was I was first lieutenant in the A-20. I was at Fort Benning. And I was on a night flight, my first one. Our airplane we had was a place for a pilot, a man in a nose, and a man behind you, a gunner. We didn't have those at that time, so you would fly by yourself. But every time you took off, people from Fort Benning, the Army people, would come over and ask to fly. So I had this first night flight, and people, so I picked two of them, put one in the nose and one behind me in the gunner's position, and off we went. And it flew about 2 or 3 hours, and then came back, but it was raining, and it was night. And as I landed, I put the brakes on, and the next thing I know, the airplane seemed like got a push, and the hydraulic system failed. So I figured, well, I'm too long on a runway and not enough to get off, so I'm going to have to try to ground loop it. I tried to ground loop it, and the next thing I know, a big ditch came up, which you don't see when you take off because you're busy. And into the ditch, and it split the right wing, and gas started pouring out. I called the tower. They sent the fire trucks out. The man in the nose got out. The man in the rear got out. And I started to lift the long canopy up to get out. I couldn't. And next I know there's a fireman up there with an axe chopping at it. And I had to sort of back away from it and everything else. And he opened it up. I'm feeling good. I mean, I survived. So I go the next morning to my squadron commander, explained to him what happened and everything else. And he understood, made a report out on it. And he said, oh, incidentally, you're scheduled for another night flight tonight. Which didn't bother me at all until I got out to there and these people standing around that wanted to fly the night before, no one wanted to fly with me. And I couldn't figure it out. Well, I finally figured it out, but it kind of shook me up a little. But off I went, flew it, no problem.
I'm sure if you were listening to Mr. Decker describe ending up in that ditch, you had an image in your mind of what that scene might have looked like. And you don't have to imagine. He actually has a photo of that, and we have it up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You'll see the A-20 with its nose in the ditch. You'll see where the right wing snapped and fuel started leaking. And you'll see that cockpit that he had to be rescued from. There are a few more photos, too. And I mentioned how you've flown so many of the aircraft models on display at Castle Air Museum. I'll name a few. The B-17, B-25, C-47. We're just scratching the surface there. But one of the reasons you flew so many different aircraft was what your duties were after you came back from North Africa. As the war went on, more and more air crews needed training, and they needed it quickly. We've heard a lot of veterans describe on this program how they would practice shooting targets being towed through the air by airplanes. And I guess some of them might have been shooting at you because you were flying those planes, towing the targets for most of the rest of World War II, right?
Well, after I came back and had some duty time in the East Coast, went back at the end of the war to Germany in the occupation, spent 3 years in Wiesbaden, Germany, and I was on the Inspector General's inspection team for which we had bases in Italy, Austria, and Germany. And spent 3 years doing that, but it was one of those things where It was 2 weeks in, 2 weeks out, not too much family life. And so my wife at that time, we had two children. She was taking care of them, and I was out hustling until I finally got 3 years in Germany, came back, and was assigned to SAC in Colorado Springs. And they wanted me to be in the inspection team, and I said, told them that I would prefer not to, because there's no family life. So I became a base personnel officer, ran football teams and baseball teams, and enjoyed that until 15th Air Force decided to move to California, and I went to Florida. Well, I was personnel officer down there, and then became a base operation officer, and then finally assigned to the air refueling squadron, the first one in SAC, and became an air refueler. As we said, we used to pass gas.
Passed a lot of gas at high altitudes. And SAC, for those who don't recognize that acronym, that's Strategic Air Command. And for many years, that's what Castle Air Force Base here in Atwater was the center of. And of course, the base is no longer open. The museum is here, and so many of those great aircraft are preserved. In fact, one of those that you have a chance to climb aboard and explore is the KC-135. You're wearing the hat. You spent a lot of time in those, and I want to get to that, but let me backtrack a little bit. I think some folks, since this show focuses so often on World War II, and we hear about a lot of the guys who came through the ranks and were trained here and there and everywhere, and they talk about as aerial gunners having to shoot at sleeves being towed by other airplanes. You spent a lot of time as a pilot towing targets stateside the rest of World War II?
Yes, that's correct. So it was towing targets for any aircraft, both where they'd fire at us and also for just tracking for the guns on the ground, also for fighters. In fact, we were assigned to Walterboro, South Carolina, and we were towing targets for a fighter group of Tuskegee, the Black Fire Pilots, and we did that for about a year until they moved on and we moved on to back overseas.
So as you're flying all these targets, maybe this sounds like a dumb question to you, but I'm sure a lot of people out there are wondering, were you ever concerned that some of these rookie pilots or aerial gunners might be a little trigger happy or a little inaccurate and might give you some trouble?
Well, one of the things was if you're up in the front, you don't see what's going on behind you. Example, we got B-17s for tow targets, and then I'd go back in the tail and look. And, of course, we were towing for fighter pilots at the time, and you could see them coming in and swerving right toward you. It looks like got your tail before they start firing, and then they pull away. So it made it just kind of I think I'll go back up in the front and stay where I'm supposed to be. But other than that, and same thing in the anti-aircraft, when they fired at you, the shell exploded in front of you. It went past the target. But it really didn't cling. We did have some instances where the airplanes were hit. B-34s, a twin-engine bomber type that we were towing with, and they did get some shells or hits in the bottom of the airplane, but nothing serious, so we just accepted. The only time I did have one problem was we also did night flying for searchlights where they tracked us and everything else, and I was flying with a WASP co-pilot, and so she was flying along, it was night, and I looked down and looked into the searchlight, hit me, and for a minute I was sort of blinded, and everything else started to go back and forth, and I looked at the airplane and righted it out and started to find a way, and the WASP looked at me, she says, "What the hell were you doing?" So she didn't know, I didn't explain it to her. And other than that, the rest of it was kind of you just expected to do what you're supposed to do and didn't have any trouble. I've flown like from Guam to United States in KC-97s. It took me 18 hours to get to Hawaii. I had to land and then take off a crew rest and go to Marshfield in California, another 10 hours. So it was about 28 hours of flying. I also flew at 10,000 feet or lower into all the weather. Then I got into KC-135s. We flew at 30,000 feet. And from Guam to the States, it was 10 hours and 30 minutes. So it's kind of luxury when you get into the jet airplanes.
Yeah, it's a big difference from what you're flying in World War II. And that's why I wanted to ask you about this time as a tow target pilot, because it appears that gave you the opportunity to fly a wide variety of aircraft, that you got to experiment. Was that fun for you to feel out all these different aircraft, or was that a little nerve-wracking because it was unfamiliar.
Well, the only problem we had in the beginning was that the training program in the individual organizations was different. And like when I got into the first Tow Target outfit, I arrived, and next day I ran to a pilot saying, he's going to Memphis. Would you like a ride? So I said, certainly. Well, he's flying a B-34, which was a twin-engine bomber, and I flew as co-pilot. We landed at Memphis, spent the day, night, came back the next day, and he said, would you like to land? Well, I'm just new at the base. I said, sure, I'd like to land. So I landed it, and the next morning, I come down to operations. They said, you're scheduled to fly a Tow Talk mission today for the anti-aircraft. I said, well, I'm not checked out or anything. Oh, yes, you are. The captain said he checked you out yesterday. He did? Yeah. So then he said, well, you have to have a test of 25 questions, which is easy to make out. So I made it out, sent me out to the airplane. And I said, I didn't watch him start it. But anyway, he didn't have a co-pilot, but he had a crew chief, and he knew how to start it. So, in fact, he even wanted to fly it when I got in the air. So I took off, no problem. And that's the way a lot of those airplanes rides in those 25 different airplanes that they had at the base. Somebody take me out to the airplane and say, here's the throttle, there's this. And I say, you going to ride with me? Oh, no, I got something else I got to do. So off I go on my own. And in those days, young kids, boy, we didn't have any problem.
One of the planes that you flew that we haven't heard a lot about but has a history here in California, a lot of them were based here, and there were a lot of them flying around during the 1940s, but you won't find one here at Castle Air Museum, and a lot of people don't even know what they are. The B-18, how much time did you spend in those B-18s?
Oh, that was another one of those things that we were at Fort Benning, Georgia, and we had what probably one of the last B-10s sitting out there, and we had control over it, so we'd like to fly it. So they got a captain, and there was actually 10 of us, brand new cadets. And he said, okay, let's go. So we got in there, and he let each of us make a landing. And then he got off, and he said, you got it, fellas. And that's how we got the B-10. And it was something new for us because it's a big airplane, bigger than an A-20. And we found it was fun. But we had a little argument about who's going to fly next with 10 of us. But my career on flying airplanes, a lot of times, I flew an airplane that minimum checkout. In other words, they had to have somebody fly this to there. Off you go. And you made it. Come back.
Well, what about today? I mean, you're only 93. You're in pretty good shape. If one of those planes out here on the field at Castle Air Museum was fly ready and they fired it up for you, would you take it down the runway and see what you could do?
I think I could do it. I mean, I still have some of that go, go, go that I had when I was young. That I can remember because I was real strict in how we did it. We had checklists and everything else, and I had a co-pilot would check everything else, make sure we were ready to go. Here we went. I didn't expect to have any trouble.
That's the way it was. John Decker, 93 years old. I know he doesn't sound like he's that old. When we come back, we're going to explore some of his adventures during the Cold War from the Berlin airlift and beyond. When Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, John Decker of Merced, California, spent 28 years in the Air Force. He flew a whole lot of planes, many you've never even heard of. And in addition to World War II, he carried out some very interesting roles in the war that we always seem to forget about, the Cold War. The first major crisis of the Cold War, of course, came in 1948 with the Soviet blockade of Berlin. And for close to a year, American planes were dropping what added up to over 4,700 tons of supplies to keep West Berlin free. Later, Mr. Decker commanded a squadron of KC-135s, those giant jets that flew around the world refueling B-52 bombers. I'm curious, though, having seen the laundry list of military aircraft that you've actually flown in your long career, which one did you like the most? What was your favorite airplane?
The last one I flew was KC-135, and that is a dream airplane. The 135, I think, was my favorite. I've been very many places with it, long range and everything else, although the KC-97 for a while was my best one, too, because I flew around the world and that. I got up to Greenland. And we were stationed up there by 15th Air Force, just alert during the Cold War. But we didn't have any job, so we just took 20 airplanes, an entire squadron, both flying and ground, and flew over both North Poles, the geographical one and the magnetic one. And up in that area, you don't have too many navigational aids. So it was kind of checked, but we all had our navigators and everything else. And we flew around both of them. And it's an achievement I think I don't think anybody else in the Air Force has ever made with everybody in the outfit. We used to have about 150 people, and we loaded them aboard 20 airplanes. And in line, we went, of course, North Pole first, the geographical one, and then to the magnetic pole, and landed back in Greenland. And that was all we had to do. We didn't have any alerts or flying of B-47s or anything else, so we had to make up our own training program.
Yeah, I don't think very many people can claim that distinction. I want to talk to you more about that, but let me take you back in time, because I know you lived through the Cold War and through the Vietnam era and all that other stuff. But World War II was so consuming worldwide. The world really was at a crisis point and a tipping point. And without what America and its allies did, we'd be living in a much different world. So for you, when that war came to an end, what was the significance of that for you? Do you remember how that felt to find out, you know what, this is finally over? Because you're a pretty young guy and had your whole life in front of you.
People are celebrating the end of the war. Of course, we still had Japan to go, but when he ended the European portion of it, I was just as happy as everybody else was, and feel that, well, now we go back to being survivors, not heroes. I really liked the Air Force by then, because got used to it, although it did have some of its drawbacks. But no, at the end of the war, I was just happy as anybody else.
With all the experience and flight time you had by the time 1944 and 45 came around, and here you're flying all these tow targets, were you personally content with that, or was there part of you that wanted to be overseas flying bomber missions or trying to get into fighters? Or, because I've talked to some people who really wanted to be out there, and some people said, you know, I'm just fine being back here in the States. What was your mentality about that?
I think I had to go along with the method of being in the service, and you had to do what were you told to do. So I didn't have a choice. Like when I came back from overseas and up and down the eastern coast, and then all of a sudden they said, you're going to go to Germany. Actually, they were going to tell me I was going to go to Japan. And I said, I just came back from Northwest Africa. They said, well, we have to send somebody out, but okay, but the next one you have to go. So next one came was Germany after occupation. And well, there it was. We went, and I had to wait for my wife to come over and join me with two children. But we enjoyed it and made friends over there, both German and other military friends.
Well, and you talked about how consuming that duty was and how when they asked you to have that inspection team again, you turned it down because of that. But in that time, these are the years right after World War II, to be in Germany, I bet that gave you an interesting perspective on how Germany recovered after the war and maybe even the character of the people there. Do you have any stories along those lines?
Well, when I first got to Germany on the occupation, I was at a place called Fürstenfeldbruck, and they had an orientation down there that told me that the Germans were warlike people. And I was an occupier. I would do no fraternization or anything else. That was what I got there. A year later, we were then told we were trying to teach them democracy and that we're supposed to be friends with them and everything else. So it changed in 1 year from you're an occupier to now you're a friendly type. And so it was a little hard to get over to that. But like I ran into one that worked in an office in our headquarters, a German woman. They had their first votes while we were there. And she came in the office the next day and said, I'm not going to vote anymore. I said, why? She said, well, the person I voted for didn't make it. So it's a learning factor that they ain't going to make some of them.
Yeah, they hadn't been exposed to that for a while. The Berlin Airlift, what was your role and what do you remember about that and how severe that situation was?
Well, at that time I was in the Inspector General's office. I was executive officer. And we had a new commanding general, General LeMay. He had certain ideas how to thing. And when he finally decided on the airlift, he put a directive down to the staff officers. We would fly two missions a week when it first started out because he didn't have enough pilots or enough airplanes. And we'd take one flight on Saturday, and on Sunday we'd come back, and then Sunday we'd go again. So guess what? I reported down to ops. They said, okay, we flight take Saturday, and you're taking off at night. And I took off. And what it was set up at Wiesbaden. They had a circular thing around one runway, and they lined all the C-47s up, loaded them to hilt. And the first airplane would get out in the runway, check his engines, and he'd be called Willie 1. The next one come out, he'd be Willie 2. And it was night, raining, and we climbed to 5,000 feet, take off a certain thing, make a turn at another place, and go toward Berlin and land. And so I was Willie 5, and I took off, and it was pitch dark and raining, climbed my 5,000 feet, and just melee, because we were loaded, and started toward Berlin. And I was about 50 miles from Berlin, and I'm Willie 5, and I heard Willie 6 calling in for landing instructions. That means he's passed me in the night someplace. And then as I got to Berlin, I was making my circle around, go line up with the runway, and I saw a flash behind me. So I looked back, and there was a C-47 on the ground that had spun in, manned by some lieutenant, which I don't know whether he was qualified or not, but he lost control of his airplane, and it was the first casualty, and I don't think he had too many others after that, but we did lose one at that night, my first flight. And then, of course, they came over with the C-54s and more pilots, so we went back to doing staff duty.
I know you've talked about how in the military you're just following orders and you're doing what they tell you to do, but knowing what the mission was in this instance and the lives that were depending on it, did that have any kind of impact on you or color your approach to those duties?
Oh, yes. In fact, we had some stories about some pilots who were set up to drop candy when they went by and everything else. Everybody thought that was a good idea. And we made friends with Germans in the airport and everything else. And it was a good, friendly attitude on our part and their part. Yes, we enjoyed that.
I know I'm condensing a long career into a short interview here. And you told me what your favorite airplane was, the KC-135. And I don't know how many people would say that, because that's a plane that I think is an afterthought in a lot of people's minds. People gravitate toward the fighters and the bombers. They don't think about the flying gas tank that keeps the rest of them in the air. How much pride did you take in that role, not just the plane you flew yourself, but all the guys under your leadership that were flying KC-135s?
Well, we had a very good camaraderie about 135. We had regular parties and everything else, and everybody seemed to get along real fine. Because the thing about a castle, we were the SACs, what we call finest, because every one of my pilots, boom operators and navigators, were instructor pilots. And they were selected from their home, wherever it was, as being one of the top men in the unit. So I had a group of people that you just couldn't find in one squadron. I mean, all of them that way. They were very enjoyable to meet, party with, fly with.
And I don't want to exaggerate anything, but I think about the KC-135 and its significance. You know, the Cold War, is often forgotten, and people don't realize how close we came to mutually assured destruction during those times. Is that the legacy for you of the KC-135, that without that plane, its capacity and its the range that it added for our bombers, that maybe something different would have unfolded during the Cold War? Is that an exaggeration?
No, I think that as far as I was concerned, Strategic Air Command was the only one in the service that I knew that had a mission, and that was to prevent a nuclear war. And we do that by having people on a ready to go and refueled so they could go any place in the world and strike a target. So I felt real confident that SAC was doing its job as we went along.
And it wasn't just the B-52s on their own couldn't have achieved that great a deterrent, right?
Well, and joking about it, we kept telling them, you can't get there and back without us. However, I guess it's not classified now, but in some of our E-War plans, we had to give the bomber going all the fuel he needed. Even it included that we had to give up what we had and crash land. But that was no concern. We figured we'd still hack it.
So to be clear, you're saying if our leadership greenlighted a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union or a mission of that nature, that the gas was required, the fuel was required for the B-52, you guys would sacrifice yourselves?
Well, we didn't expect, in fact, we have to crash land or something like that, because we had given all the fuel they needed. Not a question of how much we had. It was all the fuel they needed, and we were just on our own.
And to understand what that was like, because it seems so out there to us, pretty surreal of an idea. But did you actually have to process in your mind what that would be like? Were you prepared to carry out those orders if it came to that?
Yes, that's one of those things. We had a job to do, and that was it. We'll do it.
How close do you think we came?
Well, of course, there's a lot of TV broadcasting on stories about how close we came and everything else, and I really couldn't judge it. But we didn't get that far, so it must have been good.
Well, is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you think is important for us to understand? And is there something that, as you look back on this long career, that you're the most proud of?
No, I think that for the young person that needs a career, that the services would be ideal, as long as they could understand what their requirement would be. And like I have a son, he went to Vietnam, and now he's back as a wounded or a disabled Vietnam with a pension. But he's got a certain attitude, about the same as mine. He did what he's had to do, and that was it.
Well, I know you don't think that makes you a hero, but we do. And as for those who you would call the heroes, the 405,000 Americans who didn't come home from the war in World War II, how often do you think about them, and what do you think we should know today about the price that was paid for our freedom?
Well, being 93 going on 94, I keep losing more friends. About every 3 months, I go to a funeral, and it makes me very sad that I'm losing all these friends. And they were good friends, too. But that's the way life is.
How do you feel about Castle Air Museum?
Well, my observation of the museum here is that I know some of the people, they're all very dedicated, and they're all trying to keep it up, enlarge it, improve it, and I think they should be given all the help it can give from the local, both in donations and attendance to the various events they have. I think it's a great idea to look at your heritage sitting out here in their field and also inside the buildings. So I'm all in favor of the museum.
Do I have to ask you what your favorite aircraft on display is here?
135.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say that.
I like the B-47, too, but that was never been in combat, but it was a good airplane, too.
The other thing I promised I would ask you, and I've got to get just for my own good, if not for everybody else, because I would love to be able to say someday that my wife and I have been married for 72 years. What's your secret to making it work for that long?
I keep telling people the first 60 years are the hardest. From then it's downhill.
The first 60, did you say?
60 is the hardest. After that it's downhill. However, it is having a person that is you get along with and helps you. In fact, she's the one that kept me going a lot of times in the service. when I was a little down. And between the two of us, we raised four children, and that's it.
All right, let's see if their stories match up here. Ruth, you still like each other after 72 years?
Oh, yes. Of course we still like each other. We still love each other. We get along well together. We have the same interests. He looks after me completely nowadays because I'm blind. But he's taken over. Clean living, I guess, no. That's an old gag.
Are you pretty proud of him and his service?
Oh, yes, very much so. We get along, we have friends, and we do things together. I can't think of any other thing else that you go with a marriage that long. Didn't plan on it, but I didn't plan on this age either, so.
Well, I'm glad it worked out that way, and I'm glad I had the privilege of meeting you both today and hearing some of your stories. I just want to say, Mr. Decker, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us some of that. Is there anything else that you wanted to say?
No. I want to wish everybody the best of everything. And I'm not quite sure whether I wish everybody lived at 94, but give it a go.
Amen. Why not? John Decker, our guest today. I know there are so many more stories he could have told about all the different airplanes he flew. Well, maybe you'll catch him at Castle Air Museum in Atwater, and you can get a few stories out of him. Maybe you want to visit for the museum's Strawberry Waffle Brunch on April 27th or the Open Cockpit Day May 25th. You can find info on those events and all the aircraft on display, including Air Force One, which is there now. You can find that all at the museum's newly redesigned website, castleairmuseum.org. It really looks good, castleairmuseum.org. We're out of time on this edition of Hometown Heroes, but join me again next time so we can be reminded together again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
EECU reminds us of the importance of honoring our greatest generation.
Hi, I'm Paul Leffler, and there's nothing I enjoy more than honoring our hometown heroes from the greatest generation. That's why I'm so excited that Honor Flight, a nonprofit organization that flies World War II veterans to their memorial in Washington, D.C., is closing in on a very successful first year. And if that wasn't exciting enough, I'm thrilled to tell you that my friends at EECU are once again raising money to help the next round of vets make that journey.
Hurry in to EECU during the month of March to get financing as low as 2.2% APR on new and used autos. And EECU will donate $50 to Central Valley Honor Flight for every qualifying auto loan over $10,000.
In World War II, all gave some and some gave all. Let's come together and help give our veterans one more tour. With honor.
EECU. Smarter banking since 1934.
Rates subject to change. Some restrictions apply. Federally insured by NCUA.
How do you feel about that label, the greatest generation?
Well, I think every great generation seems to see the same thing. Of course, the problem is, as you get older, you go through three or four generations. And they all have the same thing. They were wild when they were young, and they're better when they're middle-aged, and they're sympathetic when they're old.